class that you will be wanting to show an interest in, I think, in the Sunday morning classes is a class in missions taught by three of the most prominent missionaries that I've ever known, Brother Dow Merritt, Dr. Henry Farrell, and Dr. George S. Benson. And this class is not just what you might think of as a class in dry principles. These men are teaching this class from the backdrop of their own experiences in these various fields. And Brother Merritt spoke this morning to a class of about 50, and we wanted to make mention of that. Henry Farrell will speak next Sunday on his experiences in Africa, and then Dr. Benson will speak the next Sunday morning on his experiences in the Philippines. But we wanted to tell you about it. I think you'll enjoy it. They meet in the trophy room of the American Heritage Building. When you hear the music of a people, you're actually listening to their heart beat. Because people write music, they write lyrics and then place these to music. They write these things out of the hungerings and the searchings of their heart. If you take that into consideration and then look at the music of the 20th century, you'll see in the first part of the 20th century probably a people who spend much time talking about keeping your chin up and not losing heart. Here are some oldies that are good. Keep the sunny side up, hide the side that gets blue. And then it says, stand up on your legs, be like two fried eggs, and keep your sunny side up. Some of you have never heard those lyrics before, but it represents a desire to keep your chin up. A more recent one is, you've got to have heart, miles and miles and miles of heart. And then there's another one, look for the silver lining whenever clouds appear in the blue. These were songs that were written to try to encourage people to keep their sunny side up and not become discouraged. More recently, in the latter part of this 20th century, the songs have taken a turn for the worse in one sense, because they are reflecting now not so much an encouragement toward keeping your chin up, but they're emphasizing more or less that we've already lost heart and there's not much hope for us. We find this reflected in some 10 years ago in the song by the Beatles, Yesterday. All my troubles seem so far away. Now it seems as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. And he goes on and talks about not being half the man he used to be. There's a cloud, it says, hanging over him. That sort of song. And then the song that they wrote entitled Help, asking for someone to help these men. And then there's a song that goes, Someone Help Me Make It Through the Night. And in this song, we see such a despair and such an abandonment. We find them saying, I don't care what's right or wrong. Showing a moral abandonment. And they're just asking for someone to help them make it through this one particular night. And they'll worry about tomorrow night the next day. But it's a futility and a frantic thrust or reach for someone to help them. And it reflects a despondency and a despair and a depression that is disturbing. Much of the world's actions harmonize with much of their music. Before the World War I, a man went into a tavern somewhere here in the United States, sat down at the piano, and composed this song. Pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. And the whole nation rallied around that song. It became the theme song of the war years. What most people did not know was that the man, after writing that song, went upstairs in the hotel and committed suicide. He was asking for help, and he was writing that song not so much as saying that he was able to do it, but just simply stating that this is what ought to be done. But he wasn't able to do it. I'm convinced that the world we live in is on an ever-increasing binge of booze and drugs and even suicide, expressing a desire to get off the merry-go-round, expressing that they've long lost hope. and that there's no use even trying any longer. We find that they're disturbed, they're depressed. We find that they're people who are frantic, looking for some meaning in life. And their attempts toward escape often culminate in suicide. In Ephesians, the second chapter, the Apostle Paul recognized that mindset when he said that, remember that at that time, you Gentiles, you were separate from Christ, you were alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, you were strangers from the covenants of promise, you had no hope, and you were without God in the world. You can't become much more degraded or separated from reality and from what's good than what Paul describes there of those people of his day. Separated, alienated, strangers, without God, having no hope. What can you add to that? But that also describes our day today. People in the world don't know where they're going. They've been ripped off by modern philosophy. They've been sold a bill of goods that says that there's no design, no purpose, no God, that there's no outside entrance into this world and there's no inside exit, that it's really a closed universe and that there's no thing or no reality above the human, that there's no superhuman, that we're here by a mere chance and we get off of it simply by death, and once you die, that's the end of it. And consequently, people have approached this life and this world as though there were no hope. And without any hope, there cannot be anything but depression and distress. But that's the bill of goods that's been sold the world today. But you know, people in the world are not the only ones disturbed by disappointment and disillusionment. They're not the only ones bothered about losing heart. You're here today. Many of you are discouraged. The Christian loses heart also. And the Christian is tempted to let his chin drop. The Christian is tempted to let his hands hang down and to let his knees droop. That is also something that afflicts the Christian as well as the person in the world. It describes many of us here today. It'll describe you tomorrow, perhaps. Today may be a good day for you. Tomorrow may not be a good day. But I'm just simply saying that I believe, frankly, that this thing of discouragement is the most common problem faced by Christians. If Satan could get into you with discouragement, he'd have you. Because everything else comes in behind discouragement. If he could discourage you men in your job, he'll destroy you. If he can discourage you housewives in your homemaking, he'll destroy you. If he can discourage you students in your studies, then he'll destroy you. If he can discourage us as Christians in whatever area of our life we may be walking at that particular time, if he can just manage to get that wedge of discouragement into your life, then he'll let all the other things that will destroy you, he'll let all those things come in if he can just get discouragement into you. And Jesus and his apostles knew this. They addressed themselves to it. Jesus said, in the world you have tribulation, John 16:33. But be of good cheer. He says, I've overcome the world. And then the Apostle Paul, in his second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 1, verses 3 through 7, uses the word comfort 10 times in 5 verses. And then in chapters 3 and 4, he uses two expressions twice. We do not lose heart, and we are of good courage. And then the whole framework of that letter is built around the common theme of encouragement. He's trying to build them up. He's trying to encourage them. Because he knows that if discouragement takes its foothold in the life of a Christian, there's not much else left for him except gloom and despair and final defeat. In the life of the Apostle Paul, this man who wrote so much about keeping your chin up and keeping your heart and not being discouraged, the man who used so much of the word comfort so many times, and the man who was always going around encouraging people to be what they ought to be and to not get discouraged, that man had enough affliction in his life to have discouraged any normal Christian person. But Paul wasn't a normal human. Sometimes I think he wasn't even a normal Christian. But I'm confident that Paul had nothing more going for him than you and I can have going for us. But in his life, there was much discouragement. I'd like to mention four common areas that you and I share with the Apostle Paul. They're not far out. They're not unusual. They're just day-to-day, common, street-level frustrations that you and I face as Christians. For one thing, in all of this, there was a serious, entrenched opposition that was being waged against the Apostle Paul by Satan. And it manifested itself in about four ways. Number one, there was outside persecution. In this 2 Corinthians letter, Paul, more than in any other letter that he wrote, Paul mentions his persecutions. He says in the first chapter of 2 Corinthians, in verses 8 and 9, and the first part of verse 9, he says, "We don't want you to be ignorant, brethren, of the affliction we experienced in Asia. For we were so utterly, unbearably crushed that we despaired of life itself. Why, we felt that we had received the sentence of death." That was a reference to his outside persecution. In chapter 4 and verse 8 and 9, he says, "We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies." But you see his reference to persecution? On over in chapter 11, he gives an extended list of all the things he had suffered. Imprisonment, beatings, the rods of the Jews, imprisonments, labors, often near death. And he goes on and talks about how he endured dangers and persecution from these people who were on the outside, his former friends perhaps, even those of his companions before he became a Christian. We don't know for sure. But the reason why I mention those is because of the fact that you and I, we know what Paul means about persecutions. You've been persecuted. If you're living the Christian life, you're going to be persecuted. In fact, Paul says everyone who does live godly will suffer persecution. Now, he doesn't mean just beatings and scourgings. If he did, that would leave out most of us, wouldn't it? But he's talking about the persecutions that you and I experience at the hands of those people with whom we used to run around. He's talking about that kind of persecution. He's talking about ridicule, men. When they ridicule you for no longer being foul-mouthed. Young ladies, he's talking about ridicule when those people with whom you used to run around ridicule you because you're no longer loose in your morals, because you no longer cheat or no longer steal or no longer revel in filthy jokes. He's talking about you as you suffer the brunt of those things that people from the outside who are your former associates, those things that they heap on you in ridicule and making fun of you. You know what he's talking about, don't you? Haven't you had some of that this summer? When you went back home for the summer, didn't you go back among those people and they look at you strangely, wondering what's come over you, and they kind of sneer and wonder about you that you've got religion? That's persecution. It's discouraging, isn't it? Because we all like to be accepted. We all like to be wanted. We all like to be a part of the gang. And I don't know of a more severe persecution that can come upon a teenager than to say, "Well, we don't want to have any part of you." That's genuine peer pressure without a peer. It's a pressure without a peer because it's forceful in the life of a young person. Paul had it. You've had it. I've had it. We all know what he means by this outside persecution. But then there was the persecution, or the disappointment rather, that came from churches that didn't measure up to the standard. In the same chapter here, in the 11th chapter, Paul says, "Apart from these things," or these other things, "there is the daily pressure upon me of my anxiety for all the churches. Who is weak and I'm not weak? Who is made to fall and I'm not indignant?" Paul talked about these churches who just didn't measure up like they should. To the Galatians, he said, "I'm astonished that you're so quickly removing from him that called you under the grace of Christ to another gospel." And then in chapter 4 and verse 19, he said, "Oh, my little children, with whom I am again in travail until Christ be formed in you." He was again in labor. His actual body was being thrown into the pangs of labor until Christ could be formed in these people. He was looking at churches that were not what they ought to be. Have you ever been discouraged over churches that were not what they ought to be? Whether it's some little insignificant group or some great big group, whether they were doing what they should as a little group or not, or whether they were doing what they should as a larger group, it doesn't matter about the size. But seeing them not do what they ought to do brings discouragement. Seeing them cold and uncaring brings discouragement. You ever been anywhere like that? I have. It may be that you're discouraged about things here and that there's some things that you'd love to say. Would you please say it to the elders and say it to me so we can make whatever correction is necessary? Don't go through life being discouraged by the church. That's what's supposed to be your encouragement. If that which should be your encouragement becomes your discouragement, pray tell me, where are you going to get your encouragement? And yet many people go through life, and where they get their encouragement amazes me, because the church which should be encouraging them is the very thing that's dragging them down. Well, you'd have to get it from somewhere, because if Satan gets the door wedged open with discouragement, you're gone. But then there's the third thing that Paul suffered, and that was he was disappointed in fellow workers. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, in verses 10 and 11, Paul refers there to those people. He refers to Demas. He said, Demas has forsaken me, having loved the present world, and he's gone to Thessalonica. And then he goes on down and says, all those who were at my first trial, no one stood with me. They all deserted me. And then back over in Philippians, he talks about those men who were actually enemies of the cross of Christ. He says, he has no one else to send to them but Timothy. He says no one else is like-minded like him. They all look after their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. I have no one like him who will be genuinely anxious for your welfare. Here was a man that was looking at the lives of his fellow workers and saw that they just weren't what they ought to be. Have you ever looked at some people of your acquaintances who were not what they ought to be? Did you ever look at a preacher or an elder or some Bible teacher and watch his life crash in front of you? What does it do to you? Well, it's discouraging. Terry tells about the man who led him to Christ. We don't know who he is, but he knows. And how Terry watched this man's life just actually crash. He lost his family, lost his wife, lost his faith. And that came first before he lost his wife and family. But nevertheless, what do you do when people that you have trust and confidence in, what do you do when they fall? What do you do when they crumble? Well, it's discouraging. Paul experienced it. You experience it also. And then he had a fourth thing that bothered him, and that was himself. Paul was troubled with himself. To the Corinthians, he said, I have to buffet my body daily and bring it into subjection, lest after having preached to other people, I become a castaway. In Romans 7:25, he says, I don't understand my own actions, for I don't do what I want to do. I do the very thing that I hate. Does that sound like somebody you know? He was discouraged at times with himself. Eugene Warren said, the strange beast I used to be still hides in the back of a mirror I sometimes find concealed in the pocket of my best suit. It's a dark and rusty mirror. I've had the pocket sewn shut, but still I feel an opaque rectangle nicking my flesh with murky corner. I smashed the cloth with heavy steel, but then the grains of dark reflection work through my skin and become seeds of pain in my bloody garden. These strange plants deceive no one. He was wrestling with himself when he wrote that. Discouraged over outside persecution? Yeah, we've had that. Discouraged over weak churches? Yes, we've had that. Discouraged over fickle and faint co-workers. That's right, we've seen that. And then discouraged over my own actions over this past week? Yes. Discouraged over my performance on a test, or discouraged over my relationship with my wife? Yes. Discouraged over many things that keep cropping up like these plants in this bloody garden that keep coming back up. And though we've sewn the pockets shut, they still seem to creep out. And we say, I don't understand myself. I don't understand my own actions. All of this discouragement. What are you going to do with it? How are you going to handle it? Well, you can do like the world and go get drunk. Or you can go bomb yourself out with drugs. Or you can sit glued to a television set and just not let your mind think. Or you can turn a radio on 24 hours a day so that there'll always be something drumming into your brain to anesthetize and keep you senseless. You can do that. Or you can do what Paul did. In the midst of all this discouragement, with himself, with the churches, with people who were on the outside, and with co-laborers, all this discouragement, Paul could say still, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I'll say rejoice. Now, Paul wasn't just whistling in the dark. He wasn't saying that and looking back over his shoulder, you know, afraid somebody's going to get him. Paul had found something. That's why he could say 10 times in 5 verses, comfort, as he not only felt the comfort of God, but as he also gave it to other people. He became a conductor of comfort. He became a conductor of encouragement. He became a conductor of things that would build people up and make them recline and rest in the Lord. These were things that Paul conducted. It wasn't that he was just whistling in the dark, playing a fool yourself game. I don't believe Paul played a fool himself game. The secret of Paul's success is found in this 2 Corinthian letter and in chapter 4 and verse 13. And I'm going to read just one part of it and draw a circle around it. And I want you to draw a circle around it if you have your Bibles. There's one word in there that's the key to Paul's success. We have the same spirit of faith as he who wrote, I believed and so I spoke. We too believe and so we speak. And the one key word that was Paul's secret of success was this simple word, belief. Paul believed. He wasn't playing a fool himself game. I'll tell you, the cat of nine tails that was lodged in the end of a scourge, of a Roman scourge, that cat of nine tails in the hands of a big burly Roman soldier beating the daylights out of your back, that overturns games real quick. People don't like to play that kind of a game. They don't like to play with that kind of a hand unless the stakes are high enough and they're sure enough of what's in their own hand that they're willing to stake the whole thing. And that's what Paul had. He had the confidence that came. He knew something. He knew something. And I'm going to tell you what those two things were. He knew a lot of things, really. But basically, they boiled down to two simple things that he knew. And I'm going to tell you, if you know these two things, the victory is yours. If you don't know these two things, I don't think you'll make it. Number one, Paul knew who God was. He knew who God was. In this Corinthian letter, 2 Corinthians chapter 4, and verses 6 and 7, or verse 6 really, listen to what he says. For it is the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. He knew who God was historically. He points back to the very creation at the beginning of time and says, it is the God who back there said, let light shine out of darkness, who has now shown in my heart so that I might see the glory of God in the presence, the prosopon, the face of Jesus Christ. He identified the God of creation with the God who came in the person of Jesus Christ. Paul knew God as an historical God. He said it's the same God that we saw in Jesus Christ, in the presence of Christ. That's the same God that said, let light shine out of darkness. He knew who God was historically. And then all the way through the writings of Paul, we see him talking about the majesty of God and that he knew God qualitatively. Paul knew the excellence of this God, the excellency of him. And that's why he could say in the Philippian letter that he counted all things as loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Jesus Christ. Why? Because Paul, having seen God in the face of Jesus Christ, knew him to be something that was beyond all price. He couldn't put a price upon it. He said, I count everything to be rubbish, everything to be garbage, that I might gain Jesus Christ and be found in him. That's how much he thought about this God. He knew him. And that's why he could say to Timothy, I know whom I have believed. I know whom, not what. I know whom. I know him whom I have believed in. And I'm confident that he's able to keep that which I've committed to him against that day. Paul knew God. But a second thing he knew where God was. He knew who God was, but he knew where God was. And that's so important. If you're going to succeed and be a success in your Christian life, you're going to have to know where God is. Do you know where he is? Where is God? Well, I don't really know where he is, but he's way off somewhere. Are you sure? Is that the God you worship? The God of the way off? That's not Paul's God. The God of the way off is not the God of the Bible. Paul said to the people on Mars Hill that God is not far from any one of us. And he was talking about heathen as well as Christian there. Because he said that in him we live and move and have our being. No, God is not the God of the far off. He's the God of the here and now. He's not a God 2,000 years ago who acted through this man, Jesus of Nazareth. That's not the God we serve. Oh, he's the God of that. But he's the God that never changes. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And in Philippians, the 4th chapter, in verse 5, when Paul says, "Let your forbearance be known to all men, the Lord is at hand." I used to think that that meant that the Lord was about to come. That's not what Paul was saying. Because if that was the case, Paul's urging us to rejoice in the Lord failed him because the Lord didn't come in time to save him from a very painful death. The Lord didn't come and save Paul there. When Paul says the Lord is Ingus or Ingus, he's near, he's at hand, he just simply means he's right next to you. That's why he says, he precedes that with saying, "Rejoice always in the Lord." Again, I'll say rejoice. Why? He says, because the Lord is standing right at your side. You know what that means? That means that wherever you go, that God is right there with you. He's sitting there with you. He's with you. He's with you. He's with me. And if I don't feel the distinct impression that Jesus Christ or God is standing here with me as I speak, I don't have anything to say. A week ago, Terry Smith told about the resurrection of Jesus. And he said, if the records be true, and we believe that they are, if these records be true, that Jesus of Nazareth was not in the grave, but was rather standing there behind Mary and said to her, "Whom are you seeking?" To whom she answered, "I'm seeking my Lord. If you've taken him away, show me where he is and I'll carry him away." He says, if he was not in the tomb, but was there. And not only was he there, he was on the road to Emmaus talking to those men as they made their journey to Emmaus. He was the one that vanished out of their sight in that house in Emmaus. He was the one that materialized among the disciples in the upper room. He was the one that materialized on the Sea of Galilee some 8 or 10 days later. He materialized wherever he chose and to whomever he pleased. If it is true that he was not in the tomb, but was there with Mary and was with Cleopas on the road to Emmaus and was with the 11 in Jerusalem, if he was wherever he wished to be at whatever time in history that he pleased to be, and then later on to the Apostle Paul, after Christ had already ascended back to his Father, he appeared to Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus. If all of those records are true, this is what it means. It means that he's here today. And we not only know who he is, I know who he is. But there is a power that I miss. If I not only know who he is, but I know where he is. There's a power that I miss unless I know that. Do you know where he is? Do you know who he is? So many of us worship an unknown God. And consequently, we say, okay, we're going to go to worship. Do you really? And when someone stands up here and leads us, we go through this ritual and this form of worshiping, and we strain and we struggle to call out of ourselves and to keep our minds centered upon the Lord. That's not worship, really. Because you can't worship somebody if you don't know him. God asks that we know him, and then our worship will become as natural as breathing. I know that that's true. Do you know who God is? I've said this many times, but please let me say it again. In straining or in trying to get my faith ordered some years ago, and in asking my own heart, do I really and truly believe, after having studied who this Jesus of Nazareth was, it suddenly dawned upon me, this is my God. I didn't realize it, but that's who he is. And then it suddenly occurred to me, if following Jesus of Nazareth means that I die and go to hell, if Jesus is there with me, that's all I care about. He's that precious to me. Everything about him thrills me. I've never seen one thing about him that doesn't absolutely capture my heart. I love that I see in Jesus Christ. I know who he is. But I'll tell you what, knowing who he is essential. Knowing where he is just as essential. You're being attacked on two fronts at least. Number one, you're being attacked and tempted to sin. Sensually. Secondly, you're being attacked and tempted to be discouraged intellectually, emotionally. These are two temptations. Temptations to sin would include all of them, but you're also tempted to be discouraged. And Satan would rather get you through this door of discouragement and lead you through this door of sin if he can. But as long as you know who God is and know where he is, then you can stand up and say, God, my will is to do your will. And then you don't even have to shout it that loud. He's standing right beside you. Just talk to him and say, my will is to do your will, and I want to be like you. And then you can stand up and the victory will be yours. But as long as you think of God and don't know who he is, and think of them as some far-off deity that can't conceive of you or anybody like you, then you won't be victorious. You're going to be the victim. But if you will worship the God who has numbered the very hairs of your head, who can materialize wherever he chooses, because his mind is infinite. He knows you. He stands beside you. His whole creation is within the scope of his brain, of his mentality, of his intellect, because he's infinite in intellect. He knows everything about everybody. And he knows when your will is bowed to him. And when it is bowed to him into submission to his will, he simply enters you and becomes a part of your body. He says that Jesus said, I and my Father will come in and we'll eat supper with you. There's the victory. That's why Paul could say, I can do all things through him that strengthens me. Because Paul knew who God was and he knew where he was. The same thing will encourage you today. Where are you? Are you discouraged? Are the people that you used to run with making fun of you? Does the church discourage you sometimes? Do fellow Christians discourage you? Do you get discouraged about yourself? All right. Do like Simon Peter did finally. He failed. And you'll probably stumble too. The Lord was walking to them on the water. Peter said, Lord, let me come. If that's really you, let me come out and walk on the water. Jesus said, come on. Peter got out on the water and began to walk toward the Lord. But then he began to look out of the corner of his eyes and see the waves and feel the wind. And he became terrified. And he began to sink. And Jesus took him by the hand and raised him up and said, why do you doubt, O you of little faith? If you keep your eye on the Lord Jesus Christ, knowing who he is and where he is, you won't see the winds of persecution and the waves of discouragement. You won't see those things. You'll pass them off. And your life will become as calm as that sea became after Jesus got in the boat. Today, you may be a Christian, you may be discouraged, you may want to come home, you may want to state it publicly. You may want to just simply stand where you are and say, by the way, from now on, I'm going to find who God is and where he is, and I'm going to live in that conscious reality constantly. If you're not a Christian, and there's some here who are not, I've seen you before the service began, and you're still here. You've never rendered obedience to Jesus Christ. We hope you will. If your faith is sufficient to make you come today and just simply state, I want to give my life to him, we'll take that confession of your faith in him and you'll be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins. And then you can be raised to walk a new life knowing who God is and where he is. And then you can say with Paul, rejoice always in the Lord. Again, I'll say rejoice. What about you today? Don't be discouraged. Do whatever it takes to discard discouragement. You come while we stand and sing.